Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Has the Democratic Party lost its way and its soul? It's managed to win the White House 4 out of the last 6 presidential elections, and thanks to demographic changes, it may well have a lock on the office for many elections to come. But some critics from the left say their party has made too many deals with the devil, subsidizing a massive health insurance industry instead of pushing for publicly financed health care for all, talking about ethics in government but doing too little to change a broken political culture, chasing Wall Street cash instead of truly progressive ideas and policies. Among them is Bill Curry. He's a former top advisor to President Bill Clinton and a 2-time Democratic candidate for governor of Connecticut. He wrote a piece recently for Salon.com, which got a huge response with a provocative title, "My Party Has Lost Its Soul: Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and the Victory of Wall Street Democrats," in which he calls for a new populist uprising to save his party. And maybe the roots of that populist uprising are right here in New England, with the likes of longtime consumer advocate Ralph Nader, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, among others. And Bill joins us right now from the studios of WNPR in Hartford. Bill Curry, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Great to be with you, Anthony. Thank you.
Yeah, and I want to tell listeners that, by the way, they can find a link to your piece at Salon.com right at RadioBoston.org. I urge everyone to click on it, read it. It's a fascinatingly provocative piece. So, Bill, let's start with this basic definition of what you're calling for, a populist movement. Define what you mean by populism.
Well, first of all, like liberal or conservative, populist is a word that is best used with conscious imprecision. There are lots of overlapping meanings to it. To many people, it really just denotes a sensibility, and it's a negative connotation. It's often used as an epithet, angry, fist-shaking, class envy. But in fact, it means something very different in my piece and very different in history. And among other things, populism has always been about defending the very small against the inevitable predations of the very big, the small farmers against the cartels of the granaries and the railroads, small businesses against big banks, communities, neighborhoods, and families against all the forces that so often rise up to threaten, even obliterate them. Secondly, it's not just – and people have to be really clear about this – it's not just liberalism on steroids. People will often say that people who want a more populist Democratic Party are for no compromise versus compromise. And it's not that at all. The question is with whom we're compromising and over what. Too many Democrats compromised with Republicans over their foreign wars and supporting the great, great tragic era of Iraq. There's a whole list of other things. The culture wars, a lot of border state Democrats do that. All Democrats are cooperating with big business. In a sense, this is a different set of compromises and in which you seek to align with civil libertarians on the right to privacy, with small businesses on credit and tax structure. There are – you know, by the way, just you know, quickly, small businesses, no constituency in America gets more lip service in less actual service than small businesses. Right. And we have a period right now which is not unlike what was going on during the rise of the agrarian populists. These great multinational corporations are like invasive species consuming everything smaller than themselves and destroying the biodiversity of our pond, the professions, nonprofits, unions, small businesses, the self-employed. And so the Democratic Party, which used to stand as a tribune for the little guy, has to do that again. And that means the courage to challenge this extraordinary conjoined political and economic establishment of big corporations and big government.
All right. Now, in your piece, speaking of compromising, you express a lot of disappointment in President Obama and, in fact, and the fact that he really hasn't led the kind of populist movement that you'd like to see. So explain that. How so? How has President Obama fallen short on this, in your view?
Well, first of all, he had a set of choices. I've been at work on a book about President Obama and the politics of populism. And it was very difficult for me when I first heard him in Boston at the John Kerry Convention in 2004. And I listened to that speech, and perhaps because I had sat next to Joe Lieberman in the state Senate and written speeches for Bill Clinton, when Obama began to speak, I thought to myself, not only have I seen this movie, I was in it, and I know how it turns out. And it turns out for those who are fundamentally concerned with the distribution of power and opportunity in this society, it doesn't turn out well. And the president made a series of decisions in the beginning of his presidency. One, just before, and as I will describe in this book, his support for the bailout was key. It was the opposite of what the Democratic Party had done in its history. When Franklin Roosevelt faced a massive banking crisis, an even more dramatic and threatening one, he didn't give the banks any money. He, in fact, bought up all the bad mortgages of the Homeowners Loan Corporation and made a profit doing so. He insured all the depositors' savings, but the banks got stricter supervision, not a subsidy. Obama did the opposite. He didn't bail out the homeowners, and he did bail out the banks. When 2009, he had the votes to raise the minimum wage, he made a decision, not driven by Republican politics, but on his own, that it would offend his business allies, and he didn't do it when the votes were there and public opinion was behind him. Most importantly to me, I've spent my life working on healthcare policy. The president ordered his own staff to walk away from the public option. It was something from the moment he was elected he didn't want to do, committed not to do. And he allowed it to be painted as if it were some kind of liberal fetish. The public option wasn't about liberals. It was about small businesses. And the problem that the president has today, the reason that a majority of Americans are still opposed to this policy for all the good things it has done, Obamacare, it hasn't brought prices down for those who don't get a subsidy, for the millions of self-employed and small businesses, and it hasn't brought costs down enough. You can't grandfather in the insurance industry and bring these prices down. It can't be done. I've spent a lifetime on this.
All right. Long as jump in
and,
here.
And so there's a set of issues here where the choices were clear. Yeah. And I just want to say one thing before we change, and that is that for many years, I didn't say, I think, publicly enough. I it's hard to criticize the president. He's so much better than the alternative. I completely get that. But I think that the people who haven't criticized him, in fact, I don't think they've done him any favors. I think we need this debate within the party, and it's only because I think that I've been writing and will continue to write in this vein.
Sure. Let me ask you this, though, Bill, in a sense. Aren't you being kind of tough on Obama? I mean, here's a guy who took over the White House when this country was on the verge of economic collapse, pulled the country back from that precipice. Now, you know, we don't know what would have happened without him. He arguably helped save the U.S. auto industry. He pushed through a major health care reform bill. It's true, not with a public option, but with a recalcitrant, even aggressive Congress. I mean, given the current atmosphere in Washington, hasn't he done just about everything one could reasonably expect?
Let me just say that it's actually the most important. It's the key case that his supporters and his most loyal supporters make. And it's basically this: with an economy so broken, a democracy so broken, and Republicans so crazy. This is, in fact, no one could have done any better. So we have to learn to live with our low expectations, because from now on, this is as good as it gets. And the first thing I want to say in response to that is that it's not enough. It's, in a sense, they've taken "yes, we can" and turned it into "actually, it turns out we can't." And so the first thing that any reform movement has to do is begin to persuade people to believe again what the president said in 2008: "Yes, we can. This isn't as good as it gets. We can do much better than this." And the second thing is, even apart from the things I just ticked off about the minimum wage and the bailout and health care, people can debate hypothetically whether we could have done better. If you look at the president's record on areas where Republicans had nothing to say, at the end of 2008, his campaign stump speech, the big peroration, was all about ethics. He promised to let cameras in, C-SPAN cameras into healthcare negotiations, not to hire any lobbyists, to keep a register of donors. And years went by and he did the opposite on all of them. And those were all his decisions. There were no Republican votes. The same is true of the use of drones, of the surveillance state. He called whistleblowers heroes and then set a record for prosecuting them while not prosecuting any of the culprits on Wall Street. These were all his decisions. And apart from being able to read his mind, which nobody can do for anyone else, I just have to say this isn't enough.
All right. So let me jump in.
And I see things that were so much – so clearly his choice. And when he was making these choices without Republican interference, it was part of the same worldview. And we have to begin to question it.
All right. So I want to ask you how we question that and what this populist uprising would look like. Who would wage it? Because you talk about a number of issues that you say could really unite people, including, for example, standing up for small business, challenging big business interests, cleaning up crony capitalism, standing up for the right to privacy, ending the endless wars and commitment to empire building overseas. So who joins that populist movement and what makes you think it would be successful?
Well, first, I think a lot of people will be at the very beginning of this will be people who are, in fact, among the president's most loyal supporters. And there's a relationship between the elites of the Democratic Party and the rank and file in which we've shut down discussion. You know, the president, again, has had less criticism from within than any Democratic president since Jack Kennedy. LBJ was driven from office by Gene McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy. Ted Kennedy did more to affect Jimmy Carter's election, I would argue, than Nader did to elect Gore's. Clinton would have been impeached by his own party had public opinion not risen up in his behalf, in my view. I don't think, as in any relationship with a spouse or a friend or a business partner, if you can't say not just the truth and nothing but the truth but the whole truth, it's not going to work. And so in this case, Democrats themselves and at rank-and-file basis have to begin – to say that they are willing to, in fact, speak up. And you have to have this Oliver Twist moment where you finally say, more, please. And so that's the first step. And then there's some tactical things. And I'll just make 2 points about it, one of which is that there are a lot of people on the left who think that this is a third party, that one of the lessons of both the Tea Party and Nader, I believe, is that in this federalist system of ours, one, it's very difficult for a third party candidate to have any impact. And secondly, it's really clear that you can have all the attributes of a third party, be fierce and independent and insistent, and operate within one of the major parties. And I don't want to be, you know, I don't want us to be extremist and angry and uncompromising like the Tea Party. But while they are having scores of think tanks debating policy and an extraordinary tumult, we've had exactly one intra-party challenge to a Democratic incumbent senator in this millennium when Ned Lamont went after Joe Lieberman. We don't have any kind of discussion. It's as if we're a zombie party walking into a period of enormous change but sleepwalking into it. And so this will begin within the Democratic Party. It will begin at a rank-and-file basis, and it will begin by our realizing that, again, we owe our leaders exactly what they owe us. Not just the truth and nothing but the truth, but the whole truth as we understand it to the best of our knowledge. And
Bill,
Democrats
hold that thought because
I
want to invite our listeners into this conversation. Listeners, whether you swing Democratic or Republican, what do you make of Bill Curry's analysis? Have the Democrats lost their way? Are you looking for a populist uprising to save the party? If so, what would that look like? And for our listeners, are the stirrings of that uprising right here in New England with the likes of Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and others? We're going to talk about that in a moment. But give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Bill, I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. Joining us is Harvard Kennedy School of Government Professor Elaine Kmark. She was one of the founders of the New Democratic Movement, which helped elect Bill Clinton to the White House. I know you guys served in the White House together, actually. She then served in the Clinton administration and later worked as a senior policy advisor to Al Gore during his 2000 presidential bid. Elaine Kmark, thank you for taking a break from your break and joining us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. And hello to Bill.
Elaine, very nice to hear your voice again. It's been a long time.
So, Elaine, what's your reaction to Bill's thesis? Are Democrats too cozy with Wall Street? Do we need a sort of, does the party need a populist uprising?
My reaction is yes and no. Okay. Yes, Democrats have been too cozy to Wall Street. I think that this is one of the great failings of the Obama administration, and I think that a lot of Democrats are very quiet, as Bill alluded to, about being disappointed in the president on this issue. No, in terms of what I think populism generally comes to be. And I would offer a little bit more nuanced view of the economy. I think there's two economies in the United States. There's the financial sector, and then there's everybody who's trying to make things every day. The financial sector is very important in some parts of the country, like New York, but frankly, it doesn't create a lot of jobs. And what the financial sector has been doing in the last two decades is they've been obsessed with maximizing shareholder value. They've been obsessed with causing a short-term mentality in CEOs. And I think that the financial sector is seriously hurting the manufacturing sector, the service sector, the sectors that actually create jobs. And therefore, I think that traditional populism tends to paint all corporations with one brush, including those corporations that do what Democrats love, make jobs. And I quote the late Senator Tsongas from Massachusetts here. Tsongas used to say, Democrats love jobs, they just hate employers. And I think that the next generation of Democrats, the post-Obama Democratic Party, if you will, has to be a party that's got a rigorous and enthusiastic growth strategy. And a lot of that growth strategy is not going to be what traditional populists are in favor of.
Mm. Bill, what do you think? Populism, I like it that Elaine brought up Paul Tsongas' idea that Democrats love jobs but not job makers.
I love Paul Tsongas and miss him greatly, a great public servant. And much of what he said I agree with. Let me just say that, it just depends on which populist you're talking about. And again, my reading of the history of populism, and I'd like to leave this just in a sentence, is that it has in fact been about scale. Populism is about frugality. It's about public integrity. If you look at what was in the People's Platform that Brian first ran on, if you look at what the Grange movement stood for, if you look at their close relations, the progressives, they were about integrity in government. They were about frugality. They wanted lower taxes. They were never about spending. In Ralph Nader's book Unstoppable that you had Ralph on, there isn't a single one of the 25 proposals that involves spending more money. This is, in fact, if we can step back from these left-right ideas a little bit for a moment in the idea that whoever's a populist hates all employers. I know I don't feel that way. Mm. I do look, in fact, though, and I agree strongly with Elaine on the idea that it is capital itself. It is Wall Street and the insurance industry that are the biggest problem. There's a neurotic dislocation of capital out of this economy into unproductive uses. Mm-hmm. We talk about job creators at just the moment they stopped creating jobs. And we talk about risk takers when, in fact, we become a nation of middlemen. Banks don't lend small businesses operating capital they desperately need because they get 3 cents every time you swipe a credit – 3% of every transaction every time you swipe a credit card. Yeah. This is not the way for us to go. But it isn't just the finance community. When you look at the retail sector, a huge part of our – the biggest part of our service economy, and you see that – while the average CEO now earns 350 times what the average worker does, in the retail, it's in the largest outfits, it's 1,500 times. We didn't see this in the Gilded Age.
So, Bill,
we didn't see this in the 20s.
Bill, I want to just throw another.
We've got to step into this and do something.
I want to throw another idea at Elaine that you brought up, and that is this idea that what the Democratic Party is lacking right now is this sort of internal. If it's not populism, forget about the label, but the sort of internal dissent in the way that the Tea Party has sort of shaken up the Republican Party. Does the Democratic Party need something like that? Because that's one of the things that Bill seems to be getting at.
Well, the post-Obama Party definitely needs it, and it's a little distressing that it hasn't begun yet.
Can we wait till then, Elaine?
I think that...
Or has it already begun?
I think in the first 4 years of the administration, there was a feeling that we were so relieved to be away from George Bush. We were so united as a party to try and get out of the recession and try to pass some kind of health care bill, although I agree with Bill on the public option. It was too bad that the administration walked away with it. But I think there was a feeling that we needed to come together because we finally had a chance to get away from George Bush and his policies, both domestic and international. What I'm a little bit worried about here is that we are now moving into a very different era. We're moving into a post-Obama era. Many of the things that were, you know, so urgent and requiring crisis management in 2009, 2010 are fading. And we don't have the same kind of rigorous debate that the Republicans have. In fact, one of my colleagues, the columnist Walter Shapiro, wrote a piece for Brookings not too long ago asking, are Democrats on Xanax? Because the Democratic primaries have been remarkably devoid of any kind of discussion over issues. And as we started studying the primaries, we thought for sure that that was going to be, you know, there were going to be some pretty vigorous debates about all sorts of issues, from privacy issues to inequality. And boy, oh boy, I'll tell you, in the Democratic primaries, we're not seeing them.
Let's love to get some listeners involved in this conversation. Listeners, we're talking to Bill Curry and Elaine K. Mark about what has to happen to the Democratic Party to shake things up. Is a populist kind of internal revolt in order? Let's go to Ken, who's calling from Concord, New Hampshire. Oh, Concord, Massachusetts. Ken, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, this is my name is Ken Deutsch, and I actually ran the draft Nader for President campaign in 92, trying to get him to run as a Democrat. So I've always been a big fan of progressive reform in the party. However, I think we have to pick our battles. I agree with everything your guest said about the economy, about minimum wage. But when it comes to health care, Obamacare is the best we could have gotten. I mean, the reality is the public option would be great, but look at the actual votes. Look at the change. We're moving in the right direction. Let's go back and visit it later. But when you just criticize the president for everything, you lose credibility.
All right, Ken, I appreciate the call. I'm going to keep that thought on the table. I want to go to Rama, who's calling from Newburyport. Rama, you're on the air.
Hello, Anthony.
Hey there.
Hello to all your guests. Yeah, my point is that I think your guest is on some. I think there's two parties, basically. I think they're morphing into a right-wing party and an ultra-right-wing party, the right-wing party being the Democrats and the ultra-right-wing party being the Republicans. I think we need more people like Bernie Sanders, like your past guest for governor, Evan Falchuk, who's running as an independent. I think we really, really, really need a third party. I know your guest would disagree. What I see here on the ground is, in Newburyport, is a lot of Democrats are very much Democrat, tried and true, fighting for good things for the people. But when people get into office, especially on the national level, even in some cases on the state level, with the hypocrisy of the establishment and things that are set up, the way things are set up, they get intoxicated, I think, by the money and the shenanigans and the rubbing shoulders with the big industry.
All right, Rama, our time is tight, yeah. So I'm going to jump in, but I take your point. We need a third party. Bill, let me throw those two ideas at you, and our time is running down, so be brief if you can. But to Ken's point that, you know, when it comes to Obamacare, this was as good as we could have gotten. And
it's what so many people believe. And again, I listed a whole set of things where there were no Republicans involved. If I can do this in one sentence, in the public option, it passed the House. It had 53 public votes in the Senate, 59 to override a veto. It needed a 60th, which would have been Joseph Lieberman. Obama never asked for it. Hmm. And there's all the evidence in the world that I found in the research for my book that he, in fact, opposed it throughout. So we don't know that it wasn't something that we couldn't get. In fact, the evidence points the other way. But the real issue here is just the general question of thinking tactically. And, you don't have it when everybody's sort of second guessing how much you could accomplish or what other people are thinking, the marketplace of ideas breaks down in the same way that Wall Street's broken down. It becomes just a matter of speculation and eventually a crash. If you want to have a real debate, get up and say what you want and fight for what you want, certainly from the grassroots level on up. And this tactical thinking, which has really overtaken voters. Politicians always thought tactically, but voters go. I really think John Kerry was nominated because all those people in those late primaries went in and thought someone else liked him or would like him because of his resume or his, you know, hair, you know, his general look of him. And I think that, you know, one of the points made in that article, policy precedes message. First figure out what you believe and then how to tell people about it. It's a question of getting back to basics.
Bill, we're going to have to leave it there. That's Bill Curry. He's a former advisor to President Bill Clinton, two-time Democratic candidate for governor of Connecticut. You can find a link to his Salon.com piece, My Party Has Lost Its Soul, at RadioBoston.org. Bill, thank you so much
thank
for joining
Thank you, Anthony.
Us.
It was great to be here. Elaine, great to hear your voice again.
And nice to talk to you.
And Elaine K. Mark, professor at Harvard School of Government, thank you as well for your time.
You're welcome.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, Bill Littlefield looks at the week in sports. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back.